Welcome to the latest edition of Through the Smoke with Deputy Fire Chief Billy Goldfeder, addressing issues impacting all firefighters' safety, health, and morale.
We are here with a group of firefighters, police officers, EMTs, paramedics, nurses, and their families to talk about firstresponders.com, the website devoted to the financial life of first responders. Excuse me, what's your name? Okay, Jim, tell me, what do you like best about firstresponders.com? Is it the credit card that tells everybody you're a first responder, or their competitive mortgage rates? Oh, it's the Responder Rewards Program. Exclusive discounts you and your family get from hundreds of retail outlets, from home improvement to electronics to clothing. Up to 40% off. Great. Is this your little doggy? Hey, buddy. Everybody seems to love the benefits of firstresponders.com. Right, everybody?
You speak your own language, we speak it too. That's because firstresponders.com was created by first responders. With benefits like great mortgage products, discounts at retailers, and the first responders credit card. It's not just a credit card, it's a badge. Firstresponders.com, giving back to the people who give.
Welcome, this is Through the Smoke on radio at firehouse.com. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. We've got a very special show today. We're going to pass on a news review for this week's show. We'll get to, and there's certainly a lot going on, but we're going to pass that so we can get to the specific issue that we want to talk about today. And that, of course, is the report that came out from the Routley panel related to the nine firefighters killed in the Charleston Superstore fire. There's a lot in the news related to this, and some of course, the report, nearly 300-page report on the Superstore fire, the SOFA Superstore fire that was released a week ago Thursday, is a massive effort of hundreds of hours of work and examining hundreds of documents that began last August, 2 months after the June 18th fire that killed the nine Charleston firefighters. And it is my belief that clearly many, many things went wrong at this fire, but 2 points I want to make. One, the report is not just a value to Charleston, but the report is a value to any fire department. You take phase one and phase two of this report and use it as a template for your own organization, you'll be able to clearly improve the way you operate as well. No one should think, oh, this is Charleston's problem. This is all our problem. And secondly, these firefighters and officers who were killed did exactly what they were told, which is what firefighters are supposed to do. And when we're not told what to do, and when we're not provided strong direction, training, and related background substance, it can create a situation that also can lead to our line-of-duty deaths or injuries. But for no second should anyone think it's this show's opinion or anyone's opinion, as far as I'm concerned, that any of these firefighters did anything wrong. They did what they were trained to do, whether that be looked upon as a positive or a negative. A six-member a city-appointed panel headed by former Shreveport, Louisiana Fire Chief Gordon Routley was asked to do an independent review of every aspect of the response. And if you've looked at any part of this report, it looks pretty clear to me that no one influenced this report. What the six-member panel wanted in that report is in that report. They looked at radio transmissions, interviewed probably, I guess, almost every Charleston firefighter, certainly everyone who was working that day on the scene, studied documents, inspection reports, training records, on and on and on and on. And then, of course, the photographs and the video related to the fire to come up with, again, another excellent fire report that we can use to apply to our organizations and to apply, of course, Charleston. When the new chief starts in Charleston, that should be clear with nothing much on it other than a computer and a copy of this report with a post-it note to the fire chief from the mayor, please do this. Thanks, Joe. I don't know how much more difficult it would be than just to follow the report. And I know that the panelists are going to be working on phase three, which will be the implementation, kind of a roadmap to get where they want to go. In other words, the destination is all the recommendations in this report, but how to get there and the steps that need to be taken, how to get there in a systematic and a proper manner that will last will be phase three of the report. And with us today, we've got Gordon Routley, Mike Chiramani, and Pete Perringer, and I'll get into their background in a minute. Kevin, Tim, and Brian, Kevin Roach, Tim Sundelback, and Brian Crawford, were unable to meet with us, and it was just difficult to find one time where everybody could meet. So this was the best we could do to get this interview out to the listeners of Firehouse.com as soon as possible, so you could get a little bit more insight and a little bit more depth about what their observations were. You know, the statements that were made in this report, you know, I know a lot of folks were thinking it was going to be soft, it was going to be easy, and forget that. The statements are facts. It's my understanding that everything was done in this report can be backed up based upon fact, documentation, and then add the experience and expertise of the six panelists led by Chief Rowley, and that's where this report came from. That's what the substance is in this report. And without any further comment from me, because I'll have a lot to comment as we discuss this, I want to introduce each of the panelists real quick. First, Mike Ciarmani, Chief Fire Inspector and former Fire Chief of Lynbrook, Long Island, New York. Mike, welcome again.
Thank you.
Pete Perringer, who's the PIO for the Montgomery County, Maryland Fire and Rescue Service, and who was the spokesman and coordinated much of the public information for the panel. Welcome again, Pete. Pete Perringer, are you there?
Yes, Billy, thanks. Great to be here, and looking forward to participate.
No problem. A little delay there. And welcome, of course, Chief Gordon Routley. Gordon, welcome back to Through the Smoke.
Thanks, Billy. Good to see you.
Well, let's just start off with you, Gordon. And why don't we sit back and take a couple minutes and listen to what you have to say related to the report, the fire, the loss of these nine firefighters. Just what's up? What do you think?
Well, I guess we have to start with the loss of the nine firefighters. Any loss of firefighters' lives is a sad experience, you know, something that we've all been working to avoid, but we also know it's inevitable, you know, just based on the nature of the work that we're going to lose the lives of firefighters from time to time. But to lose, you know, nine firefighters in one building in one place at one time is, you know, creates a landmark experience, as a large-scale tragedy for the local fire department and the local community.
And considering the fact that, you know, Gordon, you make a good point just now, is that we will lose firefighters, and anyone in our business who feels we can eliminate line-of-duty deaths completely is silly and they're out of touch. Occasionally, firefighters do lose their lives for very valid reasons, but unfortunately, it appears that in Charleston, the reasons were not valid by any means. There were no lives to be saved.
No, and one of the interesting aspects of this fire is there was a life that was saved, but it had nothing to do with the nine that were lost. There was a civilian who was rescued from the building who, in our analysis, we refer to him as the luckiest man on the face of the earth, at least on that particular night, because of the circumstances of his rescue. But he was in an entirely different part of the building, and the firefighters who were lost were, as far as we know, unaware that there was even was a rescue situation.
So really, we lost situations, right?
Yeah, we lost nine firefighters fighting a fire in a furniture store, essentially, you know, trying to save a furniture store, which is, you know, just really a tragic experience and a big lesson for all of us. And we think, you know, that's the key. Half of what we were doing was trying to analyze the situation just so that everybody involved and everybody who was watching the situation could understand what happened, but then to pull the lessons out of it, because the best thing that we can do to honor those nine lost firefighters, to make something of a positive out of the experience, is to take those lessons and distribute them as widely as we can, so that that firefighters everywhere learn the lessons and understand the mistakes that were made.
Dig into the core issues, Gordon. What specifically really sticks in your mind and, of course, the panel's mind? If I was to, and for the listeners of the show, we do no preparation before the show, so Gordon and Mike and Pete have no idea what I'm going to ask them. But what if you were to pick the top issues here, the top, and that could be very subjective, the top issues as far as not happening again, or the top issues that, my gosh, I am shocked that happened, in 2007. Whatever you want to pick, but what are the ones that really are sticking in your mind, Gordon?
Well, at the top of the chain, we have to look at the factors related to the building and the factors related to the fire department. Because the building is half of the equation, or more than half of the equation, if you look at it from the perspective of it, that this is a fire that shouldn't have happened. The building was added on to without building permits. There was construction that had taken place that didn't comply with the code. In order to comply with the code, the building should have had a sprinkler system, or to avoid putting in a sprinkler system, it would have had to be divided into the several compartments with firewalls. But the obvious answer is a sprinkler system. And it had inadequate exits. Exits were locked. Being a furniture store, Sofa Superstore gives you a hint that it had a tremendous fire load inside the building. Plus, they had a significant quantity of flammable liquids that were stored in the building for various purposes. So there are just a lot of things about the building that it's easy to say this fire should not have happened. So
let's touch on that for a little bit now. So I can imagine a listener going, well, how can that happen? But honestly, I think overall in America, we're failing pretty miserably in fire inspections. And in many respects, it's just due to staffing and availability issues. Keep cutting our budget. There's only so many things we can do. But there's varied levels of inspections. Companies just doing pre-plans, which are not code enforcement, but at least allow the eyes and ears of firefighters to get inside and see what's going on, all the way to a full qualified fire inspector doing a true fire and life safety inspection. Can you dig a little bit into that, Gordon, and what happened there, and why didn't this stuff get picked up on?
Well, I think I'll let Mike Chiaromonte follow me up on this, but the big picture is Charleston wasn't doing regular fire code enforcement inspections of commercial occupancies. Did them up into the 1990s, and then probably for cost reasons discontinued the program. So the fire inspections were being done were only triggered either by complaints or by changes of occupancy or new construction. So a business that was in business and didn't change or didn't get permits to do anything wasn't inspected. So a lot of these things evolved and weren't picked up through a regular inspection process. The fire department was doing pre-fire planning visits and, in fact, had done a pre-fire plan visit to the occupancy a little over a year before the fire occurred. And a lot of firefighters were familiar with the building. In fact, the assistant chief had been shopping for furniture for a new fire station in the store a week before the fire. But, I think it's possibly a symptom of the approach we take to pre-fire planning, that crews went out and went through the motions of pre-fire planning. They went and they looked at the building, had a look. They accepted what's there at face value. They filled out a form. They made a little sketch. But they didn't pick up on the really significant issues related to that building that made the building particularly hazardous. In fact, if you looked at the pre-fire plan sheet that was filled out for it, it was nothing special. It was just a form that was filled out. And I think I don't blame the individual firefighters for that. I think that's an attitude we develop that. You got to go out and do a pre-fire plan for a building today. So let's go do this one, and we'll be back in an hour.
So the mayor's been pretty
comment.
I'll be with you in just a second, Mike. The mayor's been pretty vocal as far as him now blaming the store owner, and certainly any business has responsibility to maintain a fire safe environment. But am I to understand, and Mike, you may be able to answer this, am I to understand that the building owner did modifications, hired contractors, and whatever other changes he made in that building, and there was no contact with the city whatsoever?
It is a matter of record that a couple of the employees stated in police interviews that they did the construction work. And it appears to me that the owner may have realized that if he did bring a contractor in there, that permits would then have to be involved. So there are statements in record in the police reports from employees saying that they did the work.
Interesting. And then since the work has been was done over, say, like a 10-year period, I get the impression looking at the report, no official building inspection and no official fire inspection. And, Mike, am I correct that the fire inspectors and the fire marshals in the city of Charleston actually don't fall under the fire department, but they fall under the building department? Is that correct?
That is correct. The fire department doesn't do fire inspections at all.
So no one from the building department had been in that building for 10 years in any official capacity?
No. And again, what had happened there was when they went to the state code, which is the IBC and the IFC, just like New York City, major metropolitan-y kind of things with a certain population, uh-huh, you become exempt, which means that any requirement for annual inspections that a small town would have doesn't apply. So the cities can make up their own schedule.
Okay.
Well, Charleston did, and their schedule was, we're not doing any.
Okay, and so they were within their rights to do that, even though it sounds bad to us. They were within their rights to do that, Mike?
That is correct. And it was a matter of economics. It was a matter of making choices. What happens with fire prevention, Billy, when it comes to deciding on buying new fire hose or putting money into fire prevention? What happens?
Of course, we always buy the hose, sure.
Okay.
Similar situation there. We'll get back to you in a little bit, Mike, but thanks for that insight. Gordon, back to you. So the building is pretty much where you were focused on that. I'll pass it back to you and let you continue sharing your observations.
Yeah, so we have a building that's out of compliance with codes and standards and expectations that presents this, the excessive level of risk that was avoidable. But, that probably happens in a lot of places in America. You can find a lot of buildings for one reason or another that are, in similar circumstances. Then we have the fire department that's faced with the fire. And really, to shorten pages and pages and hours of analysis, we had a fire department that specialized in quick, aggressive interior attack that was very good at being fast and being aggressive. Had really focused on the 2.5 and 3-story narrow wood frame buildings that they have in town, and a go in and get it kind of attitude.
Sure.
And took tremendous pride in operating that way. And also, for a number of reasons, was stuck in a sort of 1970s mindset of how the fire service should operate and approach to operations.
Let's touch on that for a minute, Gordon. In the report, you identify, or you and the panel identify, the first two engine, what they did and what they laid out to establish water supply. And I'd like you to share that story, if you will, or that fact, just so our listeners can get a quick understanding of how different Charleston had been operating. And let me just add to that, if we do anything wrong long enough, we believe it to be right, especially when nothing goes wrong. And I think that fits exactly. That frames what happened down there. But tell us about the first engine, their water supply, what they were trying to feed, all that. You shared that with me when we met a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, the accepted standard operating practice in the Charleston Fire Department had evolved to where there were two engines on a first alarm assignment. The first engine went to the fire and generally initiated interior attack with booster lines working off of their tank. If there was a lot of fire, they would pull an inch and a half, but for interior fire, they generally went in with booster lines.
And it worked real well for a long time with not a lot of negative outcome. Is that correct?
Yeah, it works pretty well for room and contents fires and fires in concealed spaces. And they've done it a lot. And, they said sometimes it didn't work and they got chased out of the building and they had to go get the inch and a half. But, they took pride in that aggressive get in there, find the fire and fight hard way of fighting fires, which is, it's the way a lot of us grew up doing it. And, there's nothing wrong with conducting aggressive interior firefighting. It puts out a lot of fires and saves the day a lot of times. But going in and, and starting off with booster lines, working off of tank water is, a little more risk than a lot of us want to take these days. I think we know better these days. As the continuation of that was the second engine would then would back up the first, and if the first needed a supply line, they would reverse a 2.5-inch supply line to a hydrant and pump back to the first engine. So the biggest hose that they carried for supply line was 2.5. And the rigs were set up with a single bed, so they could only lay a single 2.5-inch supply line. Okay. So the water supply for that first engine was limited to what you can send down a 2.5-inch supply line.
Which is generally not more than about 300-400 gallons, right?
Yeah, 400 is really pushing it. Then depending on the length of the line, you're probably in the 300, 350. In one case at this fire with an exceptionally long supply, we calculated out the practical limit was under 250 is what could be delivered.
Let's talk about that specifically. How long was that lay?
That lay ended up in 1,850 feet
of the engine,
a single supply line.
The engine reverse laid from the fire to the hydrant, went looking for a hydrant, and eventually found the hydrant. Go ahead.
Yeah, this was actually the fourth engine to arrive. One of the things that happened at this fire is the first and second engines arrived out of order. The second due engine arrived first. The first due engine arrived second. So there was some confusion over who was laying the line, and it ended up both engines ended up in attack positions, operating off tank water, waiting for the fourth engine to come in and lay supply lines for them.
And at this point, there was fire showing or smoke showing?
Heavy fire on the exterior of the building, and the fire started off as an exterior track debris fire and extended into the building, but it had extended into the building at this point.
All right, there's two engines in front of the building. They're going in with tank water operating what kind of hose lines?
Inch and a half attack lines. And again, not both in the front. One is down the side toward the rear of the building operating off tank water. The other's at the front door operating off tank water. So there are two attacks into the fire from, two different sides of the fire. And one of them pulled a booster. There's a lot of talk about going at it with a booster initially. One of the engines used a booster for just a minute to hit some of the exterior fire while they pulled an inch and a half. But essentially both of them pulled inch and a half lines. But one line went directly into the loading dock area where the fire was. The second line came through from the front door all the way through the furniture store to the back and into the loading dock. So we had two inch and a half lines starting from diagonally opposite corners of the loading dock, essentially opposing direction streams. The line that came through the store was a 500-foot inch and a half. With a 60 GPM nozzle on each line, so that
this is a pre-connected 500-foot inch and a half.
It was two pre-connects connected together due to the length of 250.
Okay, so that was intentionally done. They broke it down. Okay.
Yeah, so they connected, you know, two pre-connects together and made a 500 foot.
Right.
And then, you know, the 60 GPM nozzle on each one, we calculated out, you know, that's 120 GPM flowing into the fire and the loading dock. And we calculated it would have taken about 750 to knock down the fire. So the attack just didn't deliver enough water to have any significant impact on the fire.
And they're still on booster tank now.
And they're still working on tank water.
Okay.
So the third and fourth Orion engines laid the supply lines. One of them got connected pretty quickly. The second one that was laying to the engine at the front door, they dropped the line headed for a hydrant. The engineer knew the neighborhood, knew there's a hydrant just around the corner. Got to the intersection and saw the hydrant had been taken out. Apparently, sometime in the previous couple of years, the water authority found that the hydrant kept getting knocked over because of where it was located. So they took that hydrant, and the word hadn't gotten passed around. So the hydrant he was laying to was no longer there. Then he had to find another hydrant, and there wasn't another hydrant in sight from where he was. Looking on foot, trying to find a hydrant in the tall grass down a side street, couldn't find one. Ended up laying to the next hydrant that he knew about. He actually ran out of hose before he got to the hydrant. Went onto the hydrant, hooked the engine up to the hydrant. Then he had two more lengths of 3-inch rolled in a compartment. He had to unroll those two lengths, couple them together, and he just had enough hose to reach the end of the 2.5 where he'd run out on the way to the hydrant. So he had to couple all of that together to make up the supply line, which ended up taking about 9 minutes to lay that supply line to the front door. Meanwhile, the other members of the company had taken a 2.5 inside, and they're inside the building waiting for water.
So they've laid out 1,850 feet of 2.5, feeding a 500-foot inch and a half?
Feeding a 100-foot inch and a half, a booster line that had been taken inside by another company at this point. So those two lines were flowing, and a 2.5 had been taken into the building and was back in the area of the fire waiting for water. When the line was finally charged from the hydrant, that line was charged as well. So they ended up trying to operate a 2.5, an inch and a half in a booster line from that 1,850-foot, 2.5-inch supply line.
So in reality, what was being flowed into the building?
Well, we think the actual, you know, effective flow that was into the building, the only line that was really getting on the fire on the inside was the inch and a half that was actually flowing water and was in position to attack the main body of fire. From the other side, coming in from the exterior to the loading dock, there was another 60 GPM inch and a half that crew actually got chased out of the building and had their line burned through, got outside, replaced the burned length, and they were operating from the doorway into the loading dock with a 60 GPM line.
So at the peak... At this point, with heavy fire conditions, they're flowing 120 gallons a minute out of two separate hand lines in reality.
Yeah, into the loading dock that was 2,200 square feet, wood frame construction, metal covered, and loaded with furniture.
At this point, this should have been a deck gun and tower ladder type fire.
We talked a lot about, you know, how do you deal with it? You have a loading dock that's surrounded by internal exposures on three sides.
Yeah.
You know, it's in a recess in the building, and the loading dock is fully involved.
Right.
You need about 750 GPM to knock down the fire in the loading dock, but you also don't want the fire to get into the store or into the adjoining warehouse.
Right.
So we're saying, you know, if you if you dump 750 GPM through the deck gun, you need lines inside to protect the internal exposures. Or is it possible to pull enough hand lines through the store to hit it with 750 GPM from the unburned
right.
side to the outside?
So what about the lightweight portable monitors?
I think, as people are
listening to this discussion, I'm sure they're thinking, what would I do? And I'm thinking a couple of 3-inch pre-connected lines with 5 or 600-gallon minute monitors on them, deployed with 2 firefighters each, gives you your flow.
Yeah. That's where the pre-fire plan comes in. You know, that's where that's not something you're going to figure out exactly where those lines need to go when the building's on fire and get them in place in time.
Right.
That's
right.
You have to say, okay, if the loading dock's on fire, I need one of those little guns in here, and I have one over here. We need to push it back and check for extension into all these different areas. So you have to have a pretty good idea of how you're going to fight this fire, because it's a complicated situation to figure out right there, right then. You don't have a lot of time. Plus, you have to have enough resources. The initial assignment, there was 3 three-person companies. Well, 3 three-person companies can't even take a first bite at what needs to happen at this fire.
What would this have been, in your estimation, a 50, 60 firefighter fire on the first alarm?
Yeah, well, if we look at a 4-2 or a 4-2-1 first alarm, I'm talking maybe getting 25 to 30 firefighters rolling right away.
Right.
And on initial size up, probably a second alarm based on initial size up, bringing in another 25. I think 50 firefighters rolling on in with the right equipment and the right strategy and tactics and the right incident command system to call the shots on it. If you had a chance to stop this fire, that's what it would take. And it was a challenging fire. I mean, you would have to be prepared to fight aggressively, fight hard, and flow a lot of water, and with a coordinated attack, with ventilation and placing streams in the right places. You would have to be ready to do all of those things in order to stop this fire.
And you can't do that without pre-fire planning.
You can't do it without pre-fire planning, and you can't do it without the resources that you need to do it, and you can't do it without the right techniques. A fire department that's oriented toward booster line attacks and 60 GPM inch and a half lines as the heavy backup is just not going to control a fire of this magnitude under these circumstances.
Now let's take a 2-minute break. You're listening to Through the Smoke on radioatfirehouse.com. We're talking with Chief Gordon Routley, Mike Ciarmani, and Pete Perringer, the members of the Charleston Fire Panel, related to the tragic fire that took 9 firefighters in Charleston, South Carolina, last summer. We'll be back in just a minute.
Radioatfirehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
We are here with a group of firefighters, police officers, EMTs, paramedics, nurses, and their families to talk about firstresponders.com, the website devoted to the financial life of first responders. Excuse me, what's your name? Okay, Jim, tell me, what do you like best about firstresponders.com? Is it the credit card that tells everybody you're a first responder, or their competitive mortgage rates? Oh, it's the Responder Rewards Program. Exclusive discounts you and your family get from hundreds of retail outlets, from home improvement to electronics to clothing. Up to 40% off. Great. Is this your little doggy? Hey, buddy. Everybody seems to love the benefits of firstresponders.com. Right, everybody?
You speak your own language, we speak it too. That's because firstresponders.com was created by first responders. With benefits like great mortgage products, discounts at retailers, and the first responders credit card, it's not just a credit card, it's a badge. Firstresponders.com, giving back to the people who give.
We're back. This is Through the Smoke on radio at firehouse.com. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. We're talking with Chief Gordon Routley, along with Mike Ciarmani and Pete Perringer, related to the report in the actual Superstore, the Sofa Superstore fire that came out last week. And Chief Routley, Gordon, Let's talk a little bit about, all right, so we've arrived on the scene. We've already established that there's problems with the water supply. There's tactical issues. What about managing this? Incident command, accountability. Let's talk about that.
Well, unfortunately, our analysis found that a lot of the things that most of us take for granted here in 2008, which is a strong incident management structure, using NIMS or just the basic incident command process, just wasn't in place at Charleston Fire Department. It wasn't part of their tradition.
Well, what did happen? What happened there that day?
Well, essentially we had initially the first two units on the scene were a battalion chief and the assistant chief, the shift commander. And they divided up. The assistant chief took operations at the front of the building, the attack through the store. The battalion chief took the outside position, which is where there was more fire visible. The fire chief arrived on the scene about five minutes into the operation. He met briefly with the assistant chief and said basically the same thing. You keep on managing things at the front. And he took the loading dock area, the outside attack position.
So who's basically in the language that most of us understand, which of these officers are on side A, B, C, and D?
The fire chief's on the D side. The assistant chief is on the A side, and they're running two separate operations. It's like you had it was almost like there was a D side fire and an A side fire, with one chief directing operations in each area, almost independent of each other. They only talked to each other on the radio a couple of times, and that was very brief exchanges. So what we thought of as an overall incident commander coordinating operations. And getting the big picture and maintaining situational awareness, and more than anything, calling the shots strategically, determining between offensive and defensive. There just wasn't anybody doing that. So it's like we had two sector or division commanders and no incident commander.
Right, nothing bridging the two.
In the cold analysis. What it boils down to is this fire went very quickly from a situation where there was an opportunity for offensive action. A good offensive attack might have been able to stop the fire, and I think it was a reasonable call to say it was offensive during the first few minutes.
Okay.
But the situation changed rapidly to where it needed to switch to defensive. The fire, the interior offensive attack was unsuccessful, and the fire was obviously extending. Conditions were changing. Somebody needed to make the call to say, "This is a defensive situation," and get the firefighters out of harm's way while he could. Remembering
all right, now, let's pause for a second. So we're at the point where things are getting real ugly. Let's just pause for a minute. And let me ask you this question: why did this happen? What was, and we're not slamming anybody. What's fact is fact, though. How can a department remain held in time so long? And why was there so much resistance? Because, there were opportunities, not only the day of the fire, but prior to upgrade this department, to change tactics, Was this a matter of pride? Was this a matter of stubbornness? What's the deal with this? I mean, look, I like doing things a certain way, but enough bangs on my head, I'm told I got to change. And then when I see the reason why the change will work, was it not true? Don't you identify in the report that a neighboring department offered large diameter hose at that fire and it was refused? Whether it was that day or prior to, how does it get this bad? And the next question I need you to answer, Gordon, is people listening to this show in similar fire departments, because this is just not Charleston, what do they do to get these changes to happen? So there's a lot of question for you right there.
Yeah, that's a lot to chew on, but I think, you know, there are 32,000 fire departments in the U.S., and there's nobody who can tell them all what to do. In essence, there are 32,000 independent units that decide how they're going to do business.
That's the very nature of our country, actually.
Yeah. There are some rules. There are OSHA laws and regulations, and then there are NFPA standards that are recommendations. But everybody has a considerable amount of leeway as far as what they adopt and what they believe in. For whatever reason, the Charleston Fire Department took pride in the way they were, which was they didn't follow incident command. They didn't spend a lot of time worrying about what was written down in NFPA. They had their way of doing business, and it worked for them for 30 years. It probably worked for them for 60 years. They were good at what they did and believed in what they did. But when they got to this situation, they were really outmatched.
They believed in what they did because it kept working for the most part, and even when it didn't, no one really talked about it.
Again, the organizational culture. I mean, this is the way we operate. And we talked to a lot of members of the department. Quite a number of members of the department had experience in other fire departments. Many of them were active volunteers in fire departments in the surrounding areas that had adopted a lot of the new ways of doing business that operated essentially the way we on the large scale would expect a fire department to operate in 2007 or 2008. But the culture of the organization was, we don't do that in Charleston. So if you do it that way somewhere else, forget about it when you come on duty in Charleston. If you did it that way somewhere else and you came to work here, forget about it, because we have our own way of doing business.
Right? And it's worked well. You don't see any buildings burning down.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and unfortunately, that kind of attitude is typical of the fire service. I don't know.
Yes, it is.
You know, how many fire departments do we know where we say, well, we don't care how they do it, in X, Y, or Z fire department, whether they're next door or across the country. This is the way we do
it. Or it's even worse. I mean, you get rookies out of a good fire academy, and when they're assigned to the engine company, the captain says, forget all that crap. This is how we do it at Engine 9. Even within our own organizations, we do that. So how does a firefighter, I know by reading your report and reading all the documents that there were people frustrated with Charleston, but out of the need to self-preserve and maintain their jobs, it wasn't worth fighting.
I think, the sociologist to the behavioral science spend a lot of time looking at it, saying, these people who knew better and, anticipated that this is going to go bad someday, but through, whatever pressure, went along with it and hoped for the best. And unfortunately, when luck ran out, it ran out on a very bad scale.
Right.
We talked about the neighboring fire department. The city limits of Charleston are very jagged. So they have areas where one building is in the city, the next building is outside the city.
Is that due to annexation?
Yeah, it's due to annexations, and a lot of annexations that had taken place one block at a time or one property at a time.
Right.
So they have geographically the St. Andrews Fire District has four fire stations, and the Charleston Fire Department has five fire stations, essentially covering the same geographic area, and divided up block by block or building by building as to who covered what. So they
and no cooperative automatic mutual aid.
No, they have very casual mutual aid system that they call each other if they needed each other, and a lot of times just by virtue of of addresses, they would end up at the same fire, and they would the firefighters would make it work on the fire scene. You know, firefighters are pretty good at making it work, but they're obviously, you know, two organizations with two different cultures and a lot of rivalry between them. And again, fascinating from a behavioral point of view, because there are a lot of Charleston firefighters who were previously St. Andrews firefighters. So they would come up in one system and transfer to the other. There were also St. Andrews firefighters who used to be Charleston firefighters.
Who really had to become someone else when they went to work.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a whole different act. So you have two fire departments that are, you know, in intimate contact with each other with very different approaches to operations.
Yeah.
So this fire, the St. Andrews crews arrived, and, you know, they have 4-inch hose. They could see there was a water problem. They said, do you want us to lay a 4-inch supply line? And, you know, the answer was no, we don't need that. And at one point, a thermal image camera from St. Andrews was brought over and offered to the fire chief, although, you know, he said he didn't need it. If he'd known everything that was going on, but he would have known that he needed it. But, you know, at the time, he didn't know the situation, so he turned that down. And then the St. Andrews firefighters ended up being the key players in rescuing the civilian in the back of the building, and also in attempting to go in and rescue the Charleston firefighters who were inside. But, you know, that's not to diminish the role of the Charleston firefighters. It's just that they happen to be the guys who were in.
Activities. Right. So let's tie this back now to the issues of ICS and accountability. So you've got, and again, I appreciate your comments, and I know I'm not a sociologist, but it really is fascinating to look at this, to understand this. And to any firefighter, if you personally have an issue with your department, you need to determine whether it's an issue or not. But if there's that many members that feel there are that many problems, chief, listen to what they have to say. So often our personalities get in the way of doing the right thing, or our traditions. You know, traditions, great, as long as it doesn't interfere with firefighters' ability to survive. And I think we lose touch with that sometimes. And doing something wrong for so long, it very naturally then becomes a right way to do things because you believe in it. And that's kind of what happened there. So, Gordon, let's tie it back now to the issues of ICS and accountability.
Well, you know, accountability is a huge factor in this fire. I mean, you go from the point that nobody is really performing the role of incident commander. Nobody is, you know, is at a fixed command post standing back looking at the big picture. Everybody's focused on fighting fire. Right. Now we figured out that the scene firefighters went into the store through the front door, who are operating in a 30,000 square foot furniture store in zero visibility. The smoke's banked down to the floor. And they're in ones and twos and threes. And nobody is maintaining accountability over who went in. They don't even know which companies went in, never mind which individuals. So there's no accountability system in place. There's no rapid intervention team in place. And they don't practice company integrity in the way we've come to practice it in the fire service, because their tradition is everybody get inside, find the fire. And, you know, I refer to it as a swarm attack. If everybody goes inside and we have enough firefighters and enough hose lines, somebody's going to find the fire and somebody's going to put it out.
Sure.
That's the way they operated. So we had firefighters were going in, you know, going in alone or going in and losing track of their company officers and the other firefighters from their companies. And really, you know, they were just back there in the building, and none of them, the ones that survived, so there were 16 in there, 9 survived, 7, or sorry, 9 were lost, 7 managed to get out. None of them pressed specific concern that they were out of balance with what was normal. They were used to being inside smoke-filled buildings alone fighting fire. What was different in this case was that they were 200 feet inside a building in conditions that were rapidly turning bad.
And some were in there without hose lines to follow out. I mean, some were just doing searches. So there was no, when the question is asked, why didn't they follow the hose line out, when they started to become overcome, that's not an option. They didn't all have hose lines. Is that correct?
Yeah, there were only three hose lines going in. Two of them were in operation, the inch and a half and the booster. The two and a half was waiting for water through all of this.
And so let's they're inside now. So look at one, and it doesn't matter which one. You can pick one or just give a generic scenario. So they're in there. There's not enough water. There's no one in command on the outside. Everyone's pretty much doing whatever they feel is best to try and find this fire or attack this fire. Gordon, the best you can describe it, what's it like to be one of those nine who are in there? What happened?
Well, we wish we knew exactly what happened.
Sure.
We know that at a certain point, and we figured that the time is about 1927, 27 minutes after 7, which
right.
is roughly 14 or 15 minutes after they began their operations. The companies that were operating at the back of the store abandoned their lines and started looking for ways out. We know the fire was in the void space over their heads above the ceiling. We don't know if some of the ceiling failed and fire came down on them from above. We don't know if conditions changed in the loading truck and the fire rolled in on them, or if it just deteriorated to where it was getting so hot that they all decided it was time to go at the same time. We tend to think that it was an event rather than a continual process that
okay.
caused them to go. But we know that at some point they left the hose lines and started looking for ways out.
And the radio traffic backs some of that up, of course.
Yeah, the radio traffic backs it up. We have a period from 1927, 1934, over a period of 7 minutes, on the radio tape, we picked 16 fragments of messages that are obviously firefighters in distress. They're saying things like lost contact with the hose line, need help finding a way out, running out of air. All of these things are happening way inside this building, and nobody at the fire ground is hearing it. The only person who heard and reacted to it was a battalion chief in his privately owned vehicle, who was on his way to the and heard it on his take home portable radio, and he called and tried to reach the fire chief and tell him, but couldn't get through on the radio. So he actually drove to the scene and found the fire chief face to face and told him that there were firefighters inside. In Mayday situations, the term Mayday was only used once, or was only picked up on the radio tape once.
What was the fire chief doing at this point, Gordon? Look at that period of time you just described. These firefighters are in trouble. They're calling for help. Some of their transmissions were very dramatic, related to tell their families they love them and things like that. What was the fire chief doing? What was the assistant chief doing? What was the battalion chief doing?
The fire chief was, directing tactical operations on side D, and he was directing line placement. And at that point, they had tried to operate a couple of additional 2.5-inch lines because the fire had spread to the warehouse. So they were trying to operate two and a halfs, an inch and a half, and a booster line from the single 2.5-inch supply line that was coming into that side. So he was dealing with water issues and calling for more pressure and calling for an additional engine to respond. They were setting up one of their ladder towers on that side, so he was calling for an engine company to come in. So he was dealing with that level and okay. not hearing what was going on the radio.
He was functioning, and to reiterate what you said earlier, basically as a side supervisor, as a division supervisor.
Yeah.
Okay. And the other chiefs were all doing the same thing. So none of them were focused on the big picture, and none of them were necessarily monitoring their radios?
Yeah, everybody was running around and talking. There's a lot of ambient noise at the fire ground anyway, with engines pumping and saws and everything else. So there's a lot of ambient noise, so it's difficult to hear the radio, particularly if you're, running around and talking and using the radio to give direction to somebody else. If you listen to the radio tapes, there's just a lot of radio traffic on several different subjects, all occurring on the same radio channel, one on top of another.
And we will have the links to the radio. We'll have the links to the radio traffic so our listeners can listen to that. Go ahead, Gordon. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's the radio tape is almost classic as far as how badly communications can go at a scene when you try to do too much on one radio channel at the same time. So underneath all of the radio traffic that is getting through, you have the snippets of the voices of the firefighters calling for help, but nobody is hearing them.
Including the dispatcher, right? He was, was kind of surprising to me, too. The dispatcher really saw no responsibility to monitor the radio traffic. Is that correct?
Well, the dispatchers were wrapped up for they're getting phone calls. They're calling EMS. They're calling the power company. They're making calls. They're getting calls from people calling in. They're trying to coordinate relocations. So there's an awful lot going on in the dispatch center, and they didn't pick up on it until the Mayday was called. Somebody used the term Mayday. One of the firefighters actually said a Mayday, and they recognized that. They also got a phone call from, I think it was a battalion chief who was monitoring the radio in another fire station, was listening to the station radio, and he picked up on it and called on the phone and said, did you hear that? And there was just a lot of confusion in the dispatch center, just as there was at the fire ground.
No one was specifically focused in the dispatch center on doing nothing but monitoring the radio. And clearly, no one on the fire ground assumed the responsibility as incident commander in any sense of formality.
Yeah. Yeah, and one of the things that I've figured out over the last few years in investigating several firefighter fatalities where the same kind of situation occurs is when we get a working fire and we have firefighters operating inside a building where the radio is really their lifeline, we need to have somebody at the command post whose job is nothing other than to listen to that tactical radio channel. And I'd say preferably with a headset on, because there can be a lot of other things going on, but somebody needs to be listening to that tactical radio channel and ready to react.
Because there may only be one transmission. I mean, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. It can be one. I can remember back in my days in the Phoenix Fire Department, I happened to be the guy at the command post with a headset on, and I picked up a fragment of a transmission from somebody indicating that that somebody was in trouble. Thankfully, one of the crews that happened to be nearby also and they reacted. But as far as the incident command staff, just the fact that I was the guy in the command vehicle with the headset on, I picked it up and threw the flag saying we've got a firefighters in trouble. And fortunately, in that case, we came very close to losing two firefighters in that one.
Gordon, let's touch on that for a minute, and then I want to go to Pete for a minute, and we're going to do a couple more interviews with you if you're agreeable, because there's definitely a lot to share with you and Mike and Pete. But I want to touch on that command post issue real quick and just share my thoughts, and Mike and you can certainly comment either way. For years, fire departments would say, well, we can't afford having an aide at the command post and can't afford having a driver, a chief on duty. There are other solutions. In the area we're at, here in the northeastern Cincinnati corridor, our fire chief, my department, has come up with a concept working with our neighboring chiefs called mini IMAT teams. IMAT meaning incident management assistance teams. On any reported structural fire, we're now dispatching four additional mutual aid chiefs, not necessarily apparatus, which is a whole separate type of dispatch, but we're dispatching mutual aid chiefs. So our on-duty chief gets to the scene, staff chiefs that are also responding, whether it be myself, the chief of department, our assistant chief, will go to the command post to assist the incident commander, and then our other staff may show up and someone's assigned radio, someone's assigned accountability, and then someone's commanding the incident. But we then also have these four additional chiefs do on all structural fires, basically all box alarms, with the theory that there's four sides of any building, and it's a good way to start. And we're using mutual aid chiefs to provide that support. We could not possibly, in our small department, afford drivers, any extra staff chiefs any more than we have. But yet, my boss and the area chiefs have acknowledged the fact that we need more eyes and ears on the fire ground, and that's just what you were talking about. Someone to listen to the radio, someone to do accountability. And our feeling is, by calling these mutual aid chiefs in, it's allowing us to have expertise. Basically, we're looking for people who have gray hair or no hair, and years of experience on the fire ground as a chief, giving us that advantage, allowing then captains and lieutenants to do what their job is, and that's to supervise their interior or divisional operations. I just wanted to share that there are other solutions. When I was just imagining someone listening to you talking, well, we can't afford that in our department. We can't afford to put somebody at the radio or to monitor on the command post. We need to look outside the box, so to speak, and consider your neighboring chiefs to participate in that, just like you would neighboring fire companies to supplement your staffing.
And this is Pete Perringer, and you know, there's another way of looking at it, and you kind of described the crew resource management type of perspective on things. And bringing those chiefs in with their experience and with a different perspective, you're able to achieve that. So there's many ways you can get to that, but utilizing that crew resource management. And we did talk about that a little bit down in Charleston as well.
Any comments on what I just said? Although I'd like to go to Pete for a little while for the balance of the discussion. Gordon, any comments that we just talked about as far as getting those resources there, no matter where they come from?
Yeah, I think, you know, what you've got going on in Level and Sims makes a lot of sense, because most of us don't have that many fires where we have to go to a major structured incident command system. But what
we're talking about maybe 24 runs a year where we're going to a building fire. So
So 24 runs a year, you know, where you call for the full box assignment and get those extra chiefs on the scene. And really set it up makes a lot of sense. The other part of it is simulation, and Pete can talk about it. Montgomery County has a really great command simulation system to train command officers how to operate, because most of us don't get to that many real serious fires that we develop the incident command skills by doing it. So we have to develop it by practicing it in simulation and doing it over and over again and trying different things. And in fact, I want to say a couple of things about Montgomery County, because Pete Perringer worked with us on the team on loan from Montgomery County, thanks to Chief Tommy Carr, who's just been a tremendous support to us through the whole process. And Montgomery County also invited all of the chief officers from Charleston and several other people to come up and use their command simulator to see how an incident command system should work. But that's the kind of system we need for people to learn how to manage those incidents. Because frankly, unless you're in a big city or in a metropolitan area where there are a lot of working fires, you probably aren't going to have the hands-on experience to develop those skills.
And even in the big cities, if you divide it up, gets to go to fires, it really becomes a thin number. Just no one's going to two or three working fires every day, 365 days a year. Just not out there.
Yeah. You know, I could go back to the 60s when, you know, we went to multiple alarm fires a couple of times a week, and the chiefs who were running them were old salts who handled a 100 multiple alarm fires. Times have changed, and we don't have that experience and those opportunities now. We have to create them other ways.
That's good insight on that. Pete, let's and then what we'll do is, Mike, I'd like a couple comments from you when we wrap up as far as what you urge departments to be doing so they don't replicate what happened in Charleston from a fire prevention standpoint. We'll wrap this portion of this interview up, and then we'll schedule another one for next week. But, Pete, let's talk with you for a minute. Dealing with the media and dealing with the families, clearly dealing with the families is difficult, and it's different with each family. I was reading the Post and Courier, and some of the family members, these are some of the quotes from family members. I don't have anything against the fire department. I just wish they would apologize. Man up. Say I did it. I see people all the time smoking a cigarette. They don't think twice about throwing the cigarette down. This is in relation to the people smoking in the building. Basically, it was negligence they didn't think about. Another one, I've never seen the city jump through such hoops to get things done. These fellas did a wonderful job. They're talking about you guys who did the investigation of this fire as far as the evaluation of the operation of the fire. The main thing that stuck with me is the fact that they said the fire could have been prevented. I guess there is some satisfaction in knowing what happened. We don't have to worry about what we hear anymore. There's no more guessing. And they never should have been in that building. They never should have died, said the mother of one captain. This report triggers a pursuit of accountability, covering the department's ranks within the highest levels of City Hall and any council members who are left in the dark. The brother of a captain who was killed. And then my final comments are related to the some very personal comments, I guess these quotes are. They died not really knowing why they were dying. And another quote is, I guess my heart's just breaking that he had to die needlessly. They were taking away the only thing I love. They took away the only thing I love. These guys were trained to save people's lives, to lose them needlessly, leave all these families without their loved ones. It's just not right. It's just not right. Final comment. Right now, my heart is just broken. So, Pete, you were sort of the person dealing with the outside world. How about some thoughts and observations from you in relation to the media as well as the family?
First of all, it was quite an experience, and the local media, particularly the Post and Courier newspaper, which is really the only newspaper in town, did an excellent job in their coverage and the way they approached
it
for the most part. And a lot of the TV media also were on it. But there was such a wide spectrum of emotions and comments, and you just mentioned some of the things that dealt with, but the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation had their feet on the ground very early. They developed a process and helped the formation of the South Carolina mental health. There's actually a team supporting the firefighters, support team, if you will, for counseling and all that in the city, fire department and city mayor's office, and to some degree, really worked hard to communicate with the families and share the information. So we were, for the most part, sheltered from a lot of that along the process until most recently when, the official presentation when we met with the families and so forth. And then even when we, Gordon made the four presentations in the one day, dealing with the family, the fire department, the mayor and council, and then the media, we had an opportunity for the next couple of days to meet one-on-one or in groups with not only council members, but firefighters and family members. And I think that was quite an experience. But we were able to answer some very specific questions. They had the opportunity to read the report. We did receive some very positive feedback for almost entirely as far as what was in the report and how it was written and how it was presented. There was a lot of, I think anxiety, you know, leading up to that point, and a lot of raw emotion throughout, not only community but family members, fire department, and certainly no one knew what to expect, and there was a lot going on with Chief Thomas's resignation or announced retirement. You know, the day before the report was to be released, and even the week before that, the mayor had made that decision to delay the release of our report, and then the NIOSH report came out, and then that was released in a draft form. So there was a lot going on in a relatively short period of time, and all along, you know, weeks ago, we even as team members, you know, we had some reputation management issues to deal with, and you know, there were some criticisms of everyone on both sides of the issue. So it was quite an interesting process, but I think you know, Gordon, under Gordon's leadership, the report came together pretty well, and it was you know, there's some very uncomfortable things and some things that were hard to say, but they were said and presented in such a way that I think it would make a big difference, and there was really a collective sigh of relief, you know, particularly, you know, I think the most important people to us were the families of the fallen nine. And, you know, I think they, we just got some pretty good feedback, and not all of them were on the same page or were coming from the same place, I should say,
you know, I've been,
as far as their emotions.
I've been trying to really be as open-minded as I can and monitor this. I remember when I first got the phone call that night around 7:30, 7:45 from a firefighter down there. Comments were, I'm not going to believe this, and it's getting worse, and then the phone calls just kept coming. And I guess, I don't know, whether the mayor felt this way, the citizens felt this way, the family felt this way, but I liken the discovery of how unprepared the Charleston Fire Department and their leadership was for this fire being discovered by the public as someone finding out their spouse has been cheating on them for 20 years. They thought everything was fine. Everything was good. Everything was, you know, life is good. And then one day the truth comes out, whether it be, and people are slamming ISO for the classification process. And if you understand the classification process, ISO didn't do anything particularly wrong unless somebody finds out that their inspector didn't do the right job. But ISO is a very narrow-minded view by design to look at a fire department. But how did you deal with the fact that, Pete, this community, even this mayor, and look, we could talk about the mayor all day long, but this mayor, my impression was he felt he was fooled. That, damn, I thought we had a kick-ass fire department here, the public, the families. And even those responsible to change the fire department felt that way. Any thoughts on that? I mean, that really just kind of struck me, that, God, we thought we had a good fire department until we had a big fire.
Yeah, well, the mayor is certainly a unique individual. He's been around for a long period of time, and I believe he's a great leader.
You don't keep getting reelected if something's not working. So.
Well, he's certainly, doing everything that he said he was going to do as far as we're concerned, and
right,
putting the resources into the department. And I truly believe that he wants to make that the best department in the country. And he's certainly walking that walk at this point.
Where he thought he had that.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, you mentioned ISO, and I know that that is, you know, we aspire here in Montgomery County to be a class one. I mean, I think most fire departments would like to be, but that's a community fire protection issue. It's not necessarily an accreditation of your fire department, but they marketed it in such a way, and over the years, and it became culture of the department where they believed it was marketed in such a way that it, you know, everybody, the mayor included, thought they, right, not necessarily fooled to think that they were top rated department, but they had that class one rating. So that's a kind of a side issue, but you know, I think your analogy is probably, I didn't look at it that way myself, so you just mentioned it, but I mean, that's probably a good way of looking at it. But, you know, everything really changed June 18th, and at this point in time, the resources are being put into the department. You know, we were brought into town Certainly none of the, you know, at least from my involvement, I mean, it's been very unusual in some of the ways things have happened and occurred, and nothing really surprises me anymore. But, you know, they are moving in that direction. They've accomplished an awful lot. Even our first week in town, we were very quickly able to see that they needed some, you know, changes and made some recommendations. And then the first report, to phase one report, came out with, I think it was over 200 recommendations. Pretty significant things. Staffing,
sure,
know, changing the operational tactics and training and code enforcement. And, I mean, not easy things. And the mayor says basically, okay. And he figured out how to get some of those resources in place. And, you know, in that regard, they've had a lot to do, but the department has kind of pulled up the bootstraps and able to do some things. Oh, by the way, on top of the fact that, you know, they had this tremendous emotional issue of the, you know, 9 firefighters being killed in the line of duty to deal with, and everything that went along with that. So it's been pretty incredible. But, again, the whole mental health issue, though, getting back to your question,
yeah,
is they've done a great job there with the direction and umbrella of the National Fallen Firefighters. But then the South Carolina mental health folks have set up the office and I think have done a great job dealing with not only fire department members but also family members. And it's a very complicated issue when you have 9 firefighters and working through all those issues, and I think it's been pretty incredible as far as sharing that information and make sure that they have everything that they need to get through this difficult time in their life.
What I'd like to do, and we'll work on a schedule for those listening, see if we can't do another broadcast next week or later this week so we can continue this discussion. But, Pete, what I'd really be interested in having you share with our listeners in the next volume of the show is the role of the PIO before, during, and after an incident like this, which a lot of fire departments, the role of the PIO is an afterthought. Hey, Joe, come here, be the PIO. And, you know, Joe's got to put his teeth in and now talk to the media. Not necessarily the best way to be prepared.
Right.
But so if you would, I'd sure appreciate if next time we a broadcast, which I said sounds like we can do volume 2 of the show, or volume 3, actually, because we did our first one in phase 1, talk a little bit about that, if you would.
I'd be happy to do that.
That'd be great. Mike, let's go to you real quick, because you did provide some good on-target stuff. But, Mike, and only in the interest of time, and we'll definitely come back to you and allow you to expand on this, but if you were to pick a couple of top thoughts that you want to share with the fire service so they can avoid this, particularly from a fire prevention standpoint, because that's what you do. That's fire prevention. You're known for that. It's kind of the non-sexy part of the job. Like you mentioned, if we have to fund one thing or the other, it's always not going to be fire prevention. What is your message to those listening to the show of a couple things that they might want to consider doing right away so they don't end up in a similar situation?
Billy, my first message is read the document and see how fire prevention directly saves firefighters' lives. It's not just giving coloring books out at elementary schools. That's what I want to get across. Next, I have to say that the incident where the firefighters did the pre-planning, just a 2-hour little course on basic fire inspection so they're aware of what to look for, and to know enough to call a fire inspector if they see some things. There's so much. Inspectors need to inspect a building with the eye of a firefighter. If they see something that the fire department, get that into pre-plan. Billy, we got like a minute. There's so much to talk about when it comes to this. And it's so easy for the fire service to do this. And it's just a matter of them doing it. Stop thinking it's a pain in the neck to do fire prevention. That's all.
Well, appreciate that, Mike. It can't be any more clear than that. I mean, it really we, as Rich Duffy has said for years, we do good funerals, and that's great. We do. There was nothing more beautiful what they did in Charleston, but so much of that and that fire, of course, as you guys, have, as the experts have said to us, that that fire could have been avoided, and it really, the tactics are important, the operations are important, ICS is important, but everything we just talked about is after the fact. If good fire prevention was practiced for the last 10 or 15 years in that community, with responsibility being on the store owners, the fire inspectors, the building department, and perhaps even the firefighters doing the pre-planning, we wouldn't be here talking about this today.
Well, that's so correct. The idea is that with any kind of little bit of fire prevention in any element of it with that store, we wouldn't be talking this. And it just frustrates me to death to think about it. And I'm not going to take long, but, you know, we spent all this time talking about strategy and tactics. When you got to take the strategy and tactics out of your bag, you failed.
Yeah, right, right. It's an arm wrestle with your arm down on the ground. Now you got to try to work yourself back up, whereas with fire prevention, at least you haven't even shot in the beginning to. Well, thanks, Mike. Appreciate that input there. Gordon, how about a couple final words? And if you guys are agreeable, after we shut this down, we'll go ahead and schedule something. There's so much more to talk about, and I really would like to ask you guys, and if the others are available to join us for the next discussion, to do so, because I know that the fire service is absolutely thirsty for the information. One, just out of wanting to know exactly what happened as opposed to just reading the report, but hearing it from the experts, but two, what they can do so they don't have to repeat history in their department. So, Gordon, a couple final thoughts for this particular episode.
Well, yeah, what we're doing here, I think, is probably one of the most important things that can come from this, is to share the information, because there are important lessons coming from this incident and this analysis that every firefighter in North America needs to hear and needs to absorb and digest. And you know, we set out to say, if there's anything positive we can do from this tragic situation, it's to get the word out. And if that saves the life of one firefighter, we've accomplished something. If it makes a change that saves the lives of nine firefighters, well, and maybe we've found some mathematical balance. And also, I hope that we've brought some closure to all the people directly affected by the incident, to the family members, to the other members of the Charleston Fire Department, to the members of St. Andrews who were there on the scene and involved in the action, and everybody else. So, it's an important job, and it's been a team job. It's kind of embarrassing to me that everybody refers to this as the Routley Report, because it's a six-person job, and there are six people who need to be recognized for the job.
Well, I think they were waiting to see how the report came out, because if it didn't come out well, then it clearly would have been the Routley Report.
Yeah, it's really it's really the Chiramonte and Piringer.
Roach,
sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've had a chance to talk with Kevin Roach, the assistant fire marshal in Phoenix. Tim, of course, Tim Sendelbeck, chief of training, Savannah. Brian, assistant to the chief, and Brian Crawford, assistant chief in Shreveport, separately. And when we've seen each other at some of the conferences and all, and of course, talking with Mike Chiramonte today, Pete Perringer, and of course yourself. Clearly, it's a team effort, and your modesty, though, is appreciated. However, your ability, and you've had that reputation for a long time, your ability to pull a diverse group together and produce an excellent end result is why that you're such a value to us at the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, at the IFC Safety and Health Section, and that. So while your modesty is good, and it's always good for all of us to keep in mind that we're just one person, clearly, your ability to keep that balance has mattered in producing a real fair, balanced, and appropriate report with the expert input of Pete, Mike Breyer, and Tim, and Kevin. So, anyway, thank you, Gordon. Any quick final comments? Anything else to add to that before we shut you down?
Now, just we're here. Anybody, you know, needs more information, wants to know, we'll be doing a lot of presentations. We've been invited to do a lot of presentations, so we'll be trying to get the word out. And if we can clarify anything for anybody, we're here.
Very good. Well, look, I'm going to, for the benefit of our listeners, when this gets posted, you should be able to see right on there when we're having our next show. I'm hoping to do a follow-up to this next week based upon the availability. So, again, my sincere appreciation to Chief Gordon Routley, Kevin Roach, Tim Sentelbach, Brian Crawford, and especially to Mike Cherimani and Pete Perringer, who joined us today, in honoring the 9 firefighters killed in the line of duty in Charleston by sharing with us the facts so we don't necessarily have to repeat history. You're listening to Through the Smoke. This is radio at firehouse.com. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. Take care. We'll be back real soon.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio at firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.